This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I'm pretty bullish on this as a coastal system for small communities, and I believe as we get better with the technology and we can bring the price down, I think they can be there right alongside offshore wind and solar providing to the national grids around the world.
We hear a lot about solar and wind power, but a renewable source of clean energy that continues to be largely untapped is the ocean. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the annual energy potential of waves off the coasts of the United States is 2.64 trillion kilowatt hours, or the equivalent of about 66% of this country's electricity generation in 2020. Over the past two decades, many marine energy projects have sprung up around the world, aiming to harness this seemingly limitless resource. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Andrea Copping, a senior research scientist at the Pacific Northwest Laboratory, to catch the latest on wave energy. We learn about the various technologies, the benefits these projects present, potential regulatory hurdles, and the kinds of harmful effects they may have on marine life. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrea Copping. She is a senior research scientist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and a distinguished faculty fellow at the University of Washington. Andrea, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Alex.
So you've been studying marine energy for quite some time, and there are a lot of different types of ways to tackle this untapped potential source for energy. And there's projects underway in places like Korea, Canada, Denmark, Italy. I want to dive into some of those soon, but why don't you first kind of define what is marine energy and then maybe kind of give us a snapshot of some of your latest research.
Oh, great, happy to. By marine energy, we mean generating power from any aspect of seawater. It could be moving seawater like tides and waves or ocean currents, or even the gradients in temperature and salinity. And we're not including offshore wind in this, so it's everything in the water. And as we try to develop this newest entry into the low-carbon portfolio for many nations of renewables, we realize there's a necessity to protect the oceans at the same time. The animals, the habitats, even the systems that run the ocean make it operate as it is. And what my group and I have been doing for over a decade now is trying to anticipate those potential environmental effects, understand the research that's been done, what do we know, what still needs to be done, and pursue that research. So we look at a variety of what we call stressor-receptor interactions. What are the parts of the system stressing the animals and the habitats, and the receptors, which are the animals and the habitats? And so we try to get very specific about what parts of devices, what parts of systems, is it noise, is it electromagnetic fields, is it the whirling blades of a tidal turbine, might affect the marine animals and habitats.
Before we discuss the effects on the animals themselves, why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of the different types of technologies that are being used or proposed around the world?
Yeah, for sure. So the technologies really go with the different pieces of the ocean movement of water. So if we're looking at harvesting from tides, and we get strong tidal currents where the land is constricted, it's narrow, it's maybe shallow, and the water runs very quickly with the tides. What we put in these devices, in these areas, are devices that are turbines They look a lot like a turbine you've seen in other things, including conventional hydropower in dams. However, they're quite different. They aren't as big and they don't move as fast as hydropower turbines. And they're not blocking the whole area the way a dam is. So that's how we generate tidal energy. We might moor them to the bottom or place them on the bottom or put them near the surface. When we're trying to harvest from waves, it's quite tricky. You're trying to get the energy from the up and down motion. And there's many different types of technology that have been developed and are under development to harvest sort of different aspects of the wave. Some of them are on the surface, some on the bottom, some mid water column. So there's many, there hasn't been much technology convergence there just yet. There's also the persistent ocean currents. Think about the Gulf Stream. And the idea is to put large, large turbines in places like the Gulf Stream or the Kuroshio Current off Japan. There's also various other ways you might do this. For instance, in the tropics, that warm water on the surface, in contrast to the very cold deep water, allows for a heat exchange process. You bring the cold water up and you do a heat exchanger like you might have a heat pump at your house. Those are the main ones that are under development. There are some others, but those are the main technologies. There are still many different companies with many different styles of these devices working on them.
And can you give us an idea of the potential they have in terms of replacing, let's say, coal-fired power plants or even just traditional hydropower?
That sounds like it should be a straightforward question to answer, and it's not. If we look, and we've done a lot of resource characterization, as we call it, how much energy is out there, and if you actually add it up, it's way more energy than the world uses at this point. The real question is, how much can we really technically harness? And even more so, how can we do it responsibly and avoid places perhaps that are big migratory routes for animals or places where there will be other kinds of interactions? So we believe that along the coast of many nations, including the U.S., it would be very possible to replace a substantial amount of the current non-renewable sources with ocean energy. However, I want to be clear, marine energy is probably always going to work well with wind and with solar. All these renewable sources need to work together because they have different periodicities. The sun goes down at night, sometimes the wind doesn't blow. So we need to think about how we integrate these renewables together. But there is no reason to think, particularly for coastal areas and probably across a place like the U.S., we couldn't cover the vast majority of power needs.
Now, is there a correlation in your research? Have you found a correlation between the efficiencies of some of these ocean energy technologies and the potential hazard that they pose for marine life and ecosystems in general?
That's a really interesting question. We haven't. We have the sense, because this is still a new industry, we don't have as much in the water to really look at, but we have the sense that the more machines you put out, the larger machines you put out, there's likely to be more danger of animals intersecting them. So the smaller devices may be less dangerous, but that's still a little bit of a theoretical aspect. And to be honest, we don't know enough about many of these interactions to know how dangerous they are. We have been able to understand some of them. The underwater noise coming from these devices, will it interrupt marine mammal and fish communication and navigation? Generally, we don't think so because the sounds are not that great. It's not like pile driving or ship propellers. We think the electromagnetic signals coming from the cables coming to shore are small enough, they're unlikely to affect animals that are sensitive to it. There's certain ones like the rotating blades of a tidal turbine. Could this hit a marine mammal or a series of fish or even diving birds and sea turtles? We just don't know for sure, and it's really hard to prove that it won't happen.
You mentioned the cables, Andrea. I'm curious how, beyond the cables themselves posing a potential hazard for marine life, you mentioned that they're coastal projects, but that's all relative. Some are right offshore, I imagine, but some are fairly far out? Maybe you can kind of summarize some of the projects and how far they go out from the actual land.
For sure. Well, tidal projects, because they tend to be generated in these constrictions of land, tend to be quite close to shore, maybe a kilometer, maybe a few kilometers. Some of the wave projects that are being developed will be further offshore. However, you do need to bring the electricity back to shore, which means a big, you know, electrical cable, and cables are really expensive. Their installation are expensive. So the real issue is to site a project where you've got really good energy source, but as close to land, and frankly, as close to a good port that will allow you to do maintenance and installation and so on. So we're not generally talking about things way out in the ocean, but within, 10 to 20 kilometers at most.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Copping. She's a senior research scientist at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. So, Andrea, for your work, you've been analyzing the effects of marine energy projects around the world. What are some of the ones that are working best, and which ones are a red flag for you and your team?
So the real epicenter of development, particularly for tidal energy, but wave is coming along as well, is Scotland. Northern Scotland's got amazing tidal and wave resources. And more than a decade ago, the European Union put money into the European Marine Energy Center, a test center way up north between Scotland and the Orkney Islands. And that has really helped to bring machines there for testing, which then have been spun off into actual projects. So that's where the real center of the world has been. However, in recent years, the Bay of Fundy in Canada, which is, you know, eastern Canada, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, has the highest tides in the world. We are really seeing China and Japan moving forward quickly, as is Australia, particularly with wave energy. There's a number of the other European nations. The northern ones tend to have more tidal, and the southern European nations more wave projects, Spain, Portugal, and so on. So there, it's really starting to happen a lot of places, but commercial development is really still lagging. And a lot of it comes down to the amount of money involved and sort of the political will to really put a lot of a nation's efforts into this work.
Yes, I can imagine a lot of NIMBYism, not in my backyard movements, wanting to restrict this type of expansion, whether it be from commercial fishermen to just like what you see in terms of offshore wind projects too.
Yeah, there's certainly NIMBYism, and there's pushback from the fishing community. Now, the marine energy devices and the number of them will not be nearly as large as the offshore wind devices. Offshore wind is really trying to get at the very, very large amounts of power generated from a single turbine, but have a lot of them. So we are seeing that. But it's also important to recognize the ocean's a really tough place to work, and getting devices that are robust enough to exist for a long time is tough. You have to really engineer them very strongly. And we have found that progress has been a bit slow with these large devices, such that the price of energy, the cost, levelized cost of energy, is just too high. So one of the things we have been exploring recently with some of our sister laboratories has been what we've called powering the blue economy, looking to use wave and tidal devices for smaller end uses than national grid electricity. We think of places where electrons might be worth more. Remote communities, say in Alaska or on islands that bring in diesel in order to generate electricity, that's a price point that we can meet, and we can provide the smaller amounts that are needed to supply, say, a village or a community. Similarly, as we're trying to feed the world and move aquaculture, fin fish production, and so on further offshore, we'd just as soon they didn't take their diesel gensets with them, but rather allowed wave energy to generate the power needed to run those devices, for sensors, for lighting, etc. And finally, ocean observations. This is a whole industry that isn't very visible to the public, but the number of weather buoys, other kinds of scientific instruments that with like autonomous underwater vehicles that go out and collect data and then come back. And to date, we have to go send a ship out to get them. What if we can generate the power right there in the ocean and keep these things at sea? And as we try to use the ocean more, obviously shipping, but many other uses, there is a need for power to be generated right there at sea. So this is an area of research that's really active for us and for the Department of Energy.
And are there any households that are getting their lights turned on from these projects, or are they purely in the experimental stages around the globe?
Oh, there definitely are. Up in the Orkney Islands, where the marine energy, the European Marine Energy Center is, they have too much power. They are using excess power from both tidal and wind, making it into hydrogen and using it in fuel cells for their groups of small trucks. They're starting to put it on their inter-island ferries. They are already supplying the entire island chain. There are other places that are doing this in a smaller way, in France, in China. And actually, for a while, the Verdant Energy Project in the East River of New York, right in the middle of Manhattan, was supplying a small number of stores and so on Roosevelt Island. So there's definitely active energy going into the grid. It's not tremendously widespread yet.
So, Andrea, I imagine the regulatory requirements for these projects are fairly cumbersome. Does the fact that they're not on land make it easier for these projects to get greenlit or harder?
I would say harder. Alex, it's a very complex situation. The law of the sea, UNCLOS, frankly, doesn't really come into it because to date, all of these projects are close enough to land. They're within territorial waters of individual nations. One of the projects I lead is an international initiative with 16 countries looking at environmental effects with the purpose of getting devices in the water and therefore interacting and supplying the information needed for regulatory approval. But it is complex. The U.S. has a very complex one with a lot of different agencies. A few countries like the U.K. really brought their regulatory processes under one roof, as it were, and particularly in Scotland, which has really helped. Some of the developing and some other countries have less regulatory requirements, which makes it easier to get in the water, but it's not simple at all. My group under this Ocean Energy Systems Environmental Initiative, one of the things we've been doing is gathering the science together, the evidence bases of what we understand of these interactions with machines and animals or habitats, and really trying to put it into the context of regulatory language, not just for the U.S., but for these 16 countries. How do you take the science as a regulator and apply it to what your mandate is? How do you determine what's appropriate and what's not? From that stems the requirements for the project developer to collect more data, very expensive at sea, to have more baseline information available before they're allowed to go in the water, and also how much monitoring they need to do after they've installed. How long do they need to observe a turbine with acoustic instruments and cameras to be sure nothing will collide with it, and so on.
How does it stack up compared to offshore wind, let's say, in terms of construction time and cost?
Offshore wind is a great deal more expensive, but the installations are much, much larger, and you will get much higher levels of power eventually. So there's two types of offshore wind. The common one we've seen all over Europe and what's going on in the East Coast, are bottom mounted. They are drilled or pile driven into the seafloor and then the turbine put up. In deeper water, such as we have on the West Coast, they will be floating platforms anchored to the seafloor. And so there's real differences there in both size and cost. Marine energy devices, wave and tidal, particularly the little ones I was talking about powering the blue economy, are smaller. They, in that sense, they are cheaper and easier to put in. They are also removable. If there turned out to be a problem, it's a lot easier to take something away, take its anchors out and bring it ashore and perhaps even bring it in for maintenance. But if you have a turbine that is drilled into the bottom, you can't do that. You have to do all your construction and maintenance at sea. So they're trade-offs. They're very different processes. Some of the vessels you'll use will be the same, some of the techniques, and certainly the offshore expertise is common. There's a lot we learn from offshore wind and vice versa. And the regulatory processes in most countries are fairly similar. They're a bit more different in the U.S., but there's the same sort of process that needs to be undertaken.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Copping. She's a senior research scientist at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. Now, you mentioned some of the problems in terms of construction, but you study a lot of the effects on marine life and ecosystems stemming from these projects. I'm curious if you tend to start with the apex predators or the smaller micro animals in the ecosystems, from plankton and coral to dolphins and whales. Maybe you can give us some highlights of conclusions that your team has reached.
As far as underwater noise goes, so these are machines. They're generating power. They're making noise. We know the marine mammals and the fish and certain fish species are the ones that use sound underwater as we use sight on land to communicate, to find mates, to find prey. And so we have examined that across a whole set of frequencies and decided, generally speaking, for those devices we've measured to date, the amount of noise is below a threshold level. There's a regulatory threshold level where animals are likely to be harmed or disturbed. And generally those machines are making less noise than that. So that's a good thing. Same with the electromagnetic fields. From both field and laboratory studies, what is being carried in those power cables or will be in the next 10 to 20 years is below thresholds where we believe there will be harm. So those are great. We can put them aside. And that's particularly marine mammals, fish, maybe crab, lobster. When it comes to things like corals and so on, we really think of those in terms of habitat. It's a place on the bottom of the ocean where other things live as well. And so we think hard about where you site these devices. Imagine you have an area with a whole lot of sand or soft bottom and one coral reef. You don't put the device down on top of the coral reef. So we know what those kinds of effects can be from other offshore industries, including oil and gas, and it's a matter of citing them really well. And I alluded to collision risk, animals running into these turning blades of a tidal turbine or even a turbine in a river, which we do as well, not in a dam, but just sitting in a river. That's a really, really hard one because there's nothing analogous. It's not like a hydro turbine. It's not like a ship propeller.
And tell us about OTEC, Andrea, ocean thermal energy conversion. It sounds like it could have possibilities for some remote areas that are suffering from the rising seas, for example.
If we think of tropical countries, some of the U.S. protectorates like Puerto Rico and Guam and Hawaii, but also so many island nations that are suffering from climate change, the ocean thermal energy conversion, OTEC, which is using the deep cold water and the warm surface water, this is a technology that's ready to go, just waiting for the opportunity to really get out there and demonstrate. It's much simpler technology than wave or tidal. And the great thing is it really can produce baseload power 24/7, round the clock, with little maintenance. So that's another one that I think, as we move forward, they're pretty expensive to put in. But this is could be a real saving grace, especially for small island developing states and U.S. protectorates. It has to be tropical. You need to have at least a 20 degree centigrade difference between cold, deep ocean water and warm surface water. But that covers Hawaii, Puerto Rico, all the Caribbean islands and the South Sea Islands, South Pacific Islands, as well as many, many areas of the world that are suffering sea level rise and other effects of climate change.
So you analyze the risks, but you also really understand the technology. It sounds like you're fairly bullish on the prospects of marine energy. Is that a fair assessment?
I am. And the reason is, we have to obviously mitigate climate change. The beauty of marine energy is it is pretty modular. As I've mentioned, there are some pretty big devices, but they can be made smaller and you can put as many in as you need where you need them, which means they can provide power in remote communities, islands, etc. It can really fill in some of those niches that we don't know how else to fill with renewables. Some solar, sure, but you get up to northern Alaska and there's not a lot of light in the winter. Wind turbines are tough in very extreme environments, like, again, the Arctic or Alaska. They don't work, that air. They tend to need a lot of maintenance. So I'm pretty bullish on this as a coastal system for small communities. And I believe as we get better with the technology and we can bring the price down, I think they can be there right alongside offshore wind and solar providing to the national grids around the world. So I think we can do this safely. We have to be cognizant of what we're doing and we need a lot more information and data on what might happen. To really be sure, and we need to be vigilant. But I think it's got real possibilities.
She's a senior research scientist at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, Andrea Copping. Andrea, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Santana, Charles Brown, and Van Morrison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.